A lot of people are wondering these days why we let communists have any rights in this country at all. Communists have proclaimed their hostility to the United States, its Constitution, and everything it stands for. They don't permit any of the liberties they demand for themselves. Yet if we're going to deny the communists their rights, keep our tempers and keep our heads in this kind of situation.
Where can the answers to these today, three gentlemen well-informed on public affairs, look for a partial answer in a discussion of the Bill of Rights? Members of our panel are Quincy Howe, WILL's noted news analyst and author of A World History of Our Own Times, and Royden Dangerfield, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Our moderator, WILL news director, Don Brown.
This discussion of the first 10 amendments to our national constitution is certainly most timely, and it's timely in two different ways. That is, it's timely in the sense that you indicated in your opening comments that there is a great temptation to forfeit our rights in the belief that it will help us to weather through this current international crisis. And in a second sense, the discussion this afternoon is timely because December 15th is the anniversary of the ratification of the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791, 159 years ago. Well, today, in many of our minds, it seems to me that the Bill of Rights is a phrase that seems almost sacred, and it's hard for us to realize that it, too, was once wrangled over just as some controversial legislation is today. As Thomas Jefferson thought, the Bill of Rights was tremendously important, but his political rival, Alexander Hamilton, scoffed at the amendments as being unnecessary. But this afternoon, we're not going to dwell on the historical aspects, because we want Mr. Howe and Mr. Dangerfield to discuss what these amendments mean to us today. So I'm going to start the ball rolling by reading the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Well, this First Amendment is the one that I'm sure is referred to more than all others by the average person. Well, how does it fit into the present crisis? As you were indicating at the beginning of the broadcast, Mr. Howe, just how much free speech should a communist have?
According to the Constitution and according to my own opinion, a communist should, of course, have exactly the same rights of free speech as anybody else. That is, he should have the right of free speech until he becomes a clear and present danger. Now, communists aren't the only ones who can become clear and present dangers. The right of free speech does not permit a person to shout fire in a crowded theater. That's an old way of illustrating it. But there should be no particular restrictions applied against communists because they're communists, or against communists merely for talking. You can put restrictions against communists for other reasons, but not merely for what they say. Of course, they're subject to all the usual laws of slander and libel and so on. But these recent trials that the 11 communist leaders have been going through have raised this question of free speech under the so-called Smith Act, which, as I understand it, forbids anyone to advocate violence. It's not merely forbidding the practice of violence, but the advocacy of violence. And some people feel that the Smith Act is unconstitutional because it forbids advocacy. Is that right, Mr. Dangerfield?
Yes, well,
is that
the
way you put it?
The Smith Act goes one step further, too. It forbids conspiracy to advocate or to teach violence. And it was on this basis that the communist leaders were convicted. Now, the appeal to the Supreme Court raises the question you've pointed to. The convicted communist leaders have appealed to the court on the grounds that the Smith Act, under which they were convicted, is unconstitutional because it is a breach of the First Amendment. They also appealed on the basis of procedure, the procedure of the court. The claim against the Smith Act is that it violated the injunction against Congress enacting a law abridging the right of freedom of speech and of a press and of assembly. And the court has before it then clearly the very question you've posed as to whether or not the Smith Act goes beyond the necessary steps to preserve a state against conspiracy to overthrow it, or whether the Smith Act violates the First Amendment by prohibiting freedom of assembly by prohibiting freedom of speech, by prohibiting the freedom of teaching.
Well, in view of all this agitation and all the feeling about communists, don't you think it should be pointed out, even though it perhaps doesn't bear directly on the Bill of Rights, that there are other ways in which the communists can be brought to book other than the question of free speech? There are other things that they could be tripped up on, like being the agents of a foreign power, that kind of thing. There are points on which the communist conspiracy, which certainly exists, can be checked without any invasion of rights under the Constitution.
And, of course, this is the one thing that is attempted under the McCarran Bill, the recently enacted anti-subversive act. Here, the charge is, or the way is made laid open for the government to appeal to a board created by the act to rule that the Communist Party constitutes an agent of a foreign government and that communist leaders are agents of foreign governments, requiring registration and criminal prosecution if that the action of those agents constitutes a conspiracy or constitutes espionage or constitutes anything against the safety of the state.
Well, then, as far as the communists are concerned, the McCarran Act would be a more constitutional way of hampering them than the Smith Act. There are other shortcomings to the McCarran Act which are not relevant here, I think. But,
that's right.
But as far as the constitutional rights of communists are concerned, those are not particularly attacked by the McCarran Act.
Of course,
they might be by the Smith Act.
They have been attacked by the communists as unconstitutional, too. Now, it must be pointed out, I think, that liberty is not license, and that rights are relative and they are not absolute. And the First Amendment is not an absolute. And when you get down to some of the other amendments, they very clearly are not absolutes. And the one fundamental right that a government has is the right to exist and to protect itself against attack. And whether you have a Bill of Rights or whether you don't, the government must still have that power. One of the main purposes of government, then, is self-preservation. And another main purpose of government is to prevent the safety of all being jeopardized by a few. And if the granting to communists of specific rights jeopardizes the many or jeopardizes the state, then I think the court has to rule that the First Amendment does not protect them. Well, this is a question of fact.
Well, then there's the other way, though. There's, you can also turn that the other way around and say that even though there may be a lot of reason to crack down on the communists, that in cracking down on the communists, who may deserve very little sympathy of any kind, you may nevertheless open still greater evils than the one you are attempting to cure. There is also that point of view, that you may be opening the door to the persecution and denial of rights to a whole lot of other groups, and that on balance, the relatively small amount of damage that the communists do is far outweighed by the good things that other people do who might suffer from this measure directed solely against communists.
Oh, I agree with you, and that is why I think you have to be very cautious how far you condemn the Smith Act and how far you support it. It is a borderline case, and it's one that has to be weighed, and you create a nervous situation whenever you demand that any group be shut up.
Such a man as Henry Wallace undoubtedly has run into so much trouble in recent years. Here is a man who was Vice President of the United States and certainly respected by a large percent of the population at one time, who, when he took up certain ideas that were not popular with the majority, ran into difficulty after difficulty. What can we do to protect men like Wallace, who undoubtedly was acting in all sincerity?
I'd like to tie that with the First Amendment, if I might, just for clarification, Mr. Brown. The wording of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law. Now, Congress did not make a law limiting Henry Wallace's right to make a speech. What you had were individuals either acting as individuals or acting collectively as a group take action to prevent freedom of speech. Now, again, the First Amendment is a negative. It's an injunction against Congress. Congress cannot do something. But it doesn't say that Congress must take action to protect a Henry Wallace. I want to raise that question. Now, from the point of view of democracy, I think it's just as bad that private groups suppress a Henry Wallace as that Congress does. But the First Amendment does not cover that situation.
So regardless of your personal convictions, we are now interpreting one clause in the First Amendment, true? I'd like to swing on into another aspect here of the First Amendment, and I can already see what part of your answer is going to be, Mr. Dangerfield. I think that some of these clauses are so closely interwoven that to me, at least, they seem almost inseparable. Take the case of a minority religious group. Well, you run into problems there of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and the right to hold meetings, and it's hard to separate one from the other. For instance, here is a minority religious group that is opposed to military service. Or perhaps in a given community, a group of young war veterans very much resent that group meeting in their community. So the local authorities, perhaps sympathetic to the veterans, will deny the religious group the right to use the town park or perhaps some civic auditorium. Well, now, Mr. Howe, you're a long-time member and director of the Civil Liberties Union. What's your general position about this area?
Well, I think that you should always allow these groups to have their right to talk. There are, of course, situations where you just are bound to have provocation. It isn't just a question of clear and present danger, such as you might have with the communists. It's not a question of insincerity, as with them. But take, for instance, people like these Jehovah's Witnesses people. With the most utmost sincerity, they will go around insulting other people's religion, decrying other people's patriotism, and you just cannot expect human beings to just sit and take it when things like that are said about things, about beliefs that are as closely held. These Jehovah's Witnesses, I suppose, to a certain extent, seek martyrdom for its own sake and not for some ulterior purpose the way the communists do. And therefore, one has a little more inclination to defend them on the grounds of principle. But I must say, and not speaking for the Civil Liberties Union at all, that there are occasions when if a man comes with a phonograph to play an anti-Catholic record to somebody in their house and begins to move in on the living room with the phonograph to play this record, well, I don't think that any amendment to the Constitution covers him, does it, Mr. Dangerfield?
No, there's a general rule. I think that the exercise of any right must be such as not to impair the rights of others. And I think you can't, by claiming the right of free speech or the right of assembly or the right, as you pointed out, of playing obnoxious records, you can't claim that right if at the same time you impair the rights of others, the right to peace and quiet and order, the right to be secure in his own religion.
And the right to a respect for your own religion. I mean, that would be like giving the right to make anti-Semitic speeches and the kind of thing that went on in Hitler's Germany, just provoking the worst passions in people.
I want to turn it now to another angle of this First Amendment. We have entirely neglected freedom of the press, and certainly, Mr. Howell, you and I in the School of Journalism can't let that slide by entirely unnoticed. As far as we're concerned, a milestone in freedom of the press is the famous Peter Zenger trial, when here was an obscure printer who dared to print uncomplimentary things about the governor of the colony. Well, now, I think some people today feel like the press may have entirely too much freedom. Well, Mr. Howell, you and I may be biased, so let's let Mr. Dangerfield, who is not in journalism, tell us what he thinks. Do you think we have too much freedom of press?
Well, I think, no, we haven't. We do not have too much freedom of the press, but I think we have too much license of the press. I think every newspaper editor has the right to be a fool, but I think that he abuses that right and makes a license of it in many cases. In short, what I'm saying is that the press fails, so far as I can see it as an outsider, in that it does not accept full responsibility for what it says. If a newspaper misinterprets, misquotes, and by misquoting does damage, there isn't any adequate relief for it. The law of libel does not apply. Libel has to, you have to tie with it some intent, you have to tie with it some monetary damage or punitive damage, you have to be able to assess it, and I think there is a lack of responsibility on newspaper people to interpret correctly, honestly, and squarely, and more carefully, because I think most of the mistakes of the newspaper are mistakes. They're errors of judgment or lack of effort and not malfeasance, in a sense.
I think Mr. Howell and I will go along with you that we certainly are very strongly convinced that responsibility is a keynote. We spent a lion's share of our discussion here on the First Amendment, and it's rightfully so, because I think that those aspects, freedom of religion, of speech, press, and assembly, are the things that all of us are very much concerned in, but we do want to spend time briefly on the others. So may I read Amendment 2. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And passing on to Amendment 3, no soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Well, I think, gentlemen, you would agree with me that that had great historical importance, as in these colonists had bitter memories of days back in England when the Crown would disarm a large part of the population and quarter soldiers in the homes, and the people in the colonies had unpleasant memories of that prior to the Revolution. So may we pass on then to the Fourth Amendment, which we'll want to spend a minute on. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the places to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. That swings us back into the old saying, a man's home is his castle. And we've had a recent news story on the Judith Copeland trial. Would you tell us a bit about that, Mr. Dangerfield?
Well, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals recently ordered a new trial for Judith Copeland, thereby setting aside the verdict of the district court. The appellate court held that Miss Copeland's arrest without a warrant was illegal. It also objected to the wiretapping evidence produced by the FBI. Now, the court did not hold that the FBI might not be authorized to make an arrest without a warrant, but it said that it hadn't been authorized. And rather, it suggested that maybe under the present circumstances, it might be wise to authorize arrest on a more liberal basis in certain types of cases, but that the FBI hadn't been so authorized. The court went so far then as to suggest that perhaps the FBI's power in this regard might be enlarged. The Supreme Court has recognized situations in which the police may legitimately make search and seizures without a warrant. If it is known or thought probable that a person guilty of a felony or a breach of the peace has taken refuge in a certain house, officers may, in pursuit of him, go into the house and make his arrest without a warrant. It has been held that if search is to be made of an automobile, boat, plane, or other vehicle that may escape from the jurisdiction of the arresting officer, that search may be had without a warrant. Now, this was involved in the Copeland case. The FBI claimed that they arrested her without a warrant because she was going to flee the country, and the court said that the government had not proved that case. And it suggested that in a second trial, evidence might be produced to prove it. So the Copeland case is not a clear case of outlawing an action because the FBI did something that it couldn't under the Constitution be authorized to do, but really that it did something that it hadn't been authorized to do.
Well, we can rest secure in the knowledge that here in America that we do have a great deal of freedom in our own homes, and the ordinary citizen is not going to have any violation of that, I'm sure. May we go on to Amendment 5, which is so important that we must not shortchange it. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Well, now, Mr. Dangerfield, how can we reconcile this very, very important clause, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law? How can we reconcile that with a situation in the last war when thousands of Japanese were uprooted from their homes on the West Coast? Isn't that certainly an invasion of our rights?
Japanese Americans, you mean, don't you? Not Japanese citizens,
yes,
Mr. Brown.
We'll stand that
both
addition.
Of them. Yeah. Both were involved.
Yeah.
The Japanese relocation, this relocation of Japanese American citizens, or American citizens of Japanese stock, and the relocation of Japanese aliens appears to have been dictated rather by anti-Japanese bias and hysteria on the West Coast more than by national danger. In the Korematsu case, a divided Supreme Court sustained the relocation. But in the Endo case, following the same year, 1944, a unanimous court held that Japanese citizens of proved loyalty could not be detained indefinitely. In short, you've got these two cases that don't quite jibe, but do draw a distinction between the two. Now, I don't think you can say that you can't relocate American citizens in time of danger. I think you can. I think the Korematsu case is sound on that if there is a real danger. But then, if the danger passes under the Endo case, you can't continue that relocation indefinitely. I think you can move you and me, let alone Japanese, if the national safety requires it. But on the other hand, I still think that that does not mean that you can deprive you and me of our property without due process. We did have the right to go to the court to find whether it was necessary in the Japanese case, and we'd have that right here, and the court would pass upon the question of due process.
I see. Mr. Howell, there's another angle of this I'd like to bring up for you. I know in reporting court trials, I sometimes have felt like that I had a feeling that the person testifying had perhaps been given a third degree, at least a kind of a third degree where a man is questioned for hours and hours, and then he decides to submit a long statement. Sometimes even the language of that statement didn't sound, to me at least, as if it were the language that that prisoner would have used. Well, do you think that that's almost making a man testify against himself, Mr. Howell?
It would come pretty close to that. I think that you can best, or at least I can best comment on that by merely making a little moral point that often it is not the ends that justify the means, but the means sometimes corrupt the end. And there are times when the use of rough tactics on prisoners to get information is not justified because of the means used. And once you start cutting corners and going in for violence because you say this fellow's a rascal and you want to get him, you don't care how you do it, once that begins to creep in on you, you finally get what you've got in Russia, which is the extreme example of what once was a very noble end, utterly corrupted by the most ruthless means in pursuing it. That's the extreme case.
Hasn't the Civil Liberties Union been very active in trying to protect individuals on that sort of thing?
Yeah, very much so. That's right.
Now, may we go on to the Sixth Amendment?
Well, before we leave the Fifth, I want to raise the question of due process of law, because it is a vague clause that is almost impossible of definition, and courts have not defined what constitutes due process of law. The Fifth Amendment provides that a person cannot be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and yet the only way to determine whether due process is involved in a particular case is to take it to the court and let the court say, this is due process, that is not. Basically, it's the old law of the land mentioned in the Magna Carta. It's the rule of law which English jurists have applied over the centuries. But you cannot define what is meant by it. All you can say is that when life, liberty, or property is taken, it must be by fair judicial means. And it's up to the court to define it in terms of saying this is due process, this is not due process.
That is an important phrase. Now for the Sixth Amendment. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously been ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Well, now there's something related to that. We've been reading so much in recent years of congressional investigations. There's been a great deal of criticism of them. That is, here a person is being questioned very rigorously, and he has no lawyer there to assist him or to protect him. He can't bring in witnesses to bolster his side of the argument, yet he gets widely quoted in the newspapers. So, Mr. Howell, how does that relate to this amendment?
Well, I'd put it this way, that nobody interested in civil liberties would ever want to curb the power of congressional committees to investigate. that perhaps some of these things the congressional committees do invade the privacy of the individual. The main criticism of some of the congressional committees is that their field of operation is not clearly defined, and they get into all sorts of vague ideas like un-American activities, which is not a clear thing like some of the other subjects that have been gone into. I think there also might be ways in which the person testifying before a committee could have it not done in front of Klieg lights, television cameras, and the press, that some of these things might be done with a certain amount of privacy, and thereby the congressional committee might get more information than it would with all this publicity that surrounds the hearings today.
One point must be made. The congressional committee is not a court of law, and the man is not on trial. The congressional committee partakes of some of the aspects of a trial court in that it has the right to subpoena witnesses and to punish for contempt. That is usually voted by the Congress to the committee holding the hearing. The necessity of congressional investigation is paramount. Congress must have the power to get information through investigation, and certainly the investigation procedure is legal. What is needed is really self-discipline on the part of the two houses of the Congress, setting up rules under which investigation will be conducted to avoid the abuses which have crept in late years.
We have two more amendments, both of which are related to court trials. The Seventh Amendment, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by a jury shall be preserved. And no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. And the Eighth Amendment, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Well, now, who defines excessive bail? What good is this part of the bill? How about this business of having, say, a $3 million fine on some labor organization?
Well, of course, the trial court assesses the fine or fixes the bail and determines the punishment. The amendment, however, clearly means that on appeal, the appellate court can overrule the lower court if the bail is excessive, if the fine is excessive, or if the punishment is cruel and unusual. And I think the answer to your question lies the appellate court is the protector of the individual.
Well, gentlemen, our time is growing very, very short. I want to turn to the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. The Ninth Amendment, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights, shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And the Tenth Amendment, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. One historian, I think, once referred to this last amendment as the overt declaration of the obvious, but at least historically, it did encourage two states to fall in line and approve the Ten Amendments because they were reassured that the states were going to be protected. Well, our half hour has drawn to a close, and I should still like to take a minute to stress one or two points. In their discussion this afternoon, Quincy Howell and Royden Dangerfield have given us new insight into what the Bill of Rights means to us at this critical period. So, on December 15th, the anniversary of the Bill of Rights, it would be highly appropriate for each of us as individuals to remind ourselves that the future of our liberties lies right in our own hands. It follows that because things look dark during this current period of international crisis, that we should not be stampeded into surrendering our liberties. But to make democracy flourish, we should seek to extend the liberties which protect the individual and safeguard the rights of society as a whole.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I think you've illustrated very well that the Bill of Rights is still one of America's most valuable and pertinent documents, certainly a matter of public affairs. Moderator of our program today was Don Brown, WILL News Director. Participating were Royden Dangerfield, an authority on government and public affairs, and WILL's news analyst, Quincy Howell. Be sure you're tuned to the 580 spot in your dial a week from today when we present a panel of businessmen and educators discussing a plan for action for revitalizing democracy, another important program of public affairs. This has been a tape-recorded presentation of the University of Illinois Radio Service.